Welcome to Healthcare and Hire, a podcast for healthcare professionals and aspiring healthcare executives looking for information, association, and inspiration from higher-level leaders across the healthcare industry. I'm Iqbal Acha, career consultant, healthcare recruiter, and registered pharmacist. Every week, I sit down to interview healthcare executives, clinical leaders, medical entrepreneurs, and industry experts to learn how they got to where they are today, what they see as the future of healthcare, and what they're doing to make healthcare more accessible, affordable, and effective. Let's find out more about today's guest. Dr. Syed Sumer Akhtar is the Chief Clinical Officer at Levio Health and Vice President of Stella Health, the parent company of Blue Cross Blue Shield of Minnesota. He is accountable for all clinical services which are delivered through the company's modern house call approach that includes primary, palliative, and urgent care. Dr. Akhtar joined Levio Health in March of 2021. Prior to this, he was the chief medical officer for CareMore Health, where he oversaw mobile and health network markets that served Medicare Advantage, Medicaid, and home-based care across 14 states. He has held various leadership roles throughout his career, including staff vice president at Anthem and medical director for Iora Health. Dr. Akhtar is a board-certified physician in internal medicine, and he received his medical degree from the University of Maryland School of Medicine. He also holds a master's degree in healthcare delivery science from the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth College. Hello, Dr. Akhtar. Welcome to the Healthcare and Hire podcast.
Hey, it's nice to be here. Thank you for having me. And you can just call me Sumer.
Sumer it is. No, it's great. I'm really glad that we have the opportunity to sit down and really delve into your career, your leadership legacy, your company. I'm really excited to hear your insights in terms of what you and your company are doing. And Sumer, I know that some of the listeners today have a touch with you or I, or in some cases, both. But there's also a segment of my population that's meeting you for the first time. Why don't we take this opportunity and have you introduce yourself? Tell us a little bit about who you are, what's your role, and how do you take healthcare to a higher level?
Thank you. Again, it's wonderful to be here. Thank you for having me. My name is Sumer Akhtar. I am the Chief Clinical Officer for Levio Health. In that capacity, I oversee all of our clinicians, our care management teams, and our quality, safety, and compliance teams as well. And I play an important role in helping us develop the model of care that we're using to take care of our patients. I love the fact that my career ultimately has been devoted to figuring out how we can better take care of some of the most complex patients in our society, those who are dealing with a lot of chronic conditions, a lot of serious illness, and therefore are facing a lot of hurt in their lives, both medically and sometimes, socially and behaviorally as well. And to be able to have an impact, hopefully, in that, in my own small corner of the world, is something that gets me up in the morning every day and something that I'm really excited about. So, when I think about what I can do to help take healthcare to a higher level, perhaps the one thing I would share is if I can inspire enough people, both clinicians and non-clinicians, to devote their careers to figuring out how to help us solve these very complex challenges in the care of really complex patients, I think I will have made an impact that I can be proud of.
And I think that that's a great way to approach a lot of challenges in issues that we are all seeing across healthcare, because it's not about what we do, it's about the impact that's left on the life of another individual. And, you know, we're going to talk about that in various ways. Let me kind of share some context, and I'm going to ask you to fill in some of the details about Leveo Health. Maybe many of the listeners are not familiar with the organization, but I know that it began in 2015 primarily as a mobile urgent care service, which sounds pretty unique. Like, I'm trying to imagine what the systems must have been like and how, you know, patients would be able to work with that. But it has grown quite a bit, and under the with the support of Blue Cross Blue Shield of Minnesota, I believe, you know, you've been able to expand into new markets and you're offering a variety of services. Sumer, why don't you share with me a little bit about the scope and the size of Leveo Health, maybe the number of employees that are part of this great organization, you know, how far and wide Leveo Health has patients, and maybe an advancement or two about the organization that you've been able to be either a part of in terms of leading forward or just being a witness to in order to see how far Leveo Health has come.
Yeah, no, thank you. I'm happy to share. So Leveo Health is a company that's all about creating a modern house call, not a term that I've coined, but a term that's been previously used, modern house call for the care of complex, chronically ill and seriously ill patients. We provide home-based primary care and palliative care services. We have the ability to take care of patients in their homes as well as virtually. We don't have a model that incorporates any bricks and mortar type clinics, but all of the care that we provided is focused on meeting patients where they're at in their homes. And ultimately, there are more and more organizations now that are getting into this space because I think they've realized that it's a critical need that we need to fill, because there are still several million patients that are very ill and homebound that then cannot access medical care and social care the way that you and I can, right? So I think a way to sort of bring this home, what problem are we trying to solve? I like telling stories. And so, you know, I remember a patient of mine when I was a primary care physician in Las Vegas. And, you know, she was in her 60s. She was a lady with really brittle, poorly controlled diabetes, and had suffered a lot because of the consequences of that diabetes over the course of a couple of decades. She came to my attention because she was going to the hospital at least once a month, sometimes twice a month, and would often stay there for a week or longer at a time. And, you know, was a lady, every time she would go in, her blood sugars would be in the 600s, 700s, 800s, and it would take a few days to get that under control and make sure she was on the right medications, and then they would discharge her. And it would be a matter of time before you would repeat that process all over again. So her life was just either trying to get to a doctor's appointment or going to the hospital. And it was just on a rinse and repeat cycle. When she did come to clinic, right, and she missed quite a few appointments, when she did come to clinic, you know, she seemed to be a relatively intelligent woman, right? She seemed to understand why she should take the medicine that she was being prescribed. She seemed to understand what diabetes was, but obviously something wasn't clicking. And so, you know, for a couple of months, I would see her, and then I would, you sort of like cross your fingers, she goes home, and then it was a matter of time before the next call you would get would be from the hospitalist asking questions about what's going on with her. So, I just said, I don't know exactly what to do with her, but I have to do something different. So I said, I'm just going to go visit her at home, right? Went to her home. Thankfully, she answered. I went with my social worker colleague with me, and we walk in there, and the first thing that you see is a tower of medications that look like basically just like a small hill on top of her dining table. And you cannot help but be struck by it because it's just so many pill bottles. And you start talking to her, go through the pleasantries. And while we're talking, I just go over to the table because I just can't help but be drawn to it. And you go there and you look, and it's doubles and triples and quadruplicates of like the same medications. There's so many. And I just had to stop mid-sentence and be like, hey, what's going on here? Why do you have so many medication bottles? And some of these are different doses. A lot of them are the same medicine. You know, and she looks at us and she goes, every time I think I'm supposed to take my medicine, I pick three I open them, I take a couple of pills out, I pray, and I take the pills, right? And I was like, okay, so how do you know which ones to take? Which three pill bottles do you select? And she goes, I just pick any three. I was like, why? Why don't you? I mean, we have the schedule online. She's like, well, I can't hardly see, right? And I was floored because I just felt like an idiot, right? I mean, I had known her for a couple of months and so hadn't had the chance to do a full comprehensive review of her entire health. But the first thing that I'm thinking about is, wow, I didn't even know that the reason this lady has so much difficulty taking care of her medications is because she's almost blind because of her diabetes. How she even got to clinic is beyond my understanding, but somehow she was getting there, right? The second thing I noticed was, just walking around, and I said, do you mind if I just go check out your kitchen? And she said, sure, go ahead. And I opened the fridge, and there was like a quarter loaf of bread in there. And that was the only thing in there. It was completely empty. So I walked back to her and I was saying, what are you having for lunch today? What did you have for breakfast today? And she's like, oh, nothing. I was like, why not? I was like, well, my neighbor hasn't come by today yet. I don't know if she is or not. I was like, okay, so why are you telling me that? And she said, well, she's the one who brings me food. And if she brings me some food, I have food that day. And if I don't, then I don't, right? Again, what the heck, right? And so, and then I didn't even realize that she had a son involved in her life that was kind of in and out, but was sometimes there. And you could see a whole other row of pill bottles in another room that were his things to deal with, right? How would I have known any of this stuff if I hadn't gone to her home, right? And for me, it was just like a random thing. It wasn't part of my model necessarily. No one told me to do it. I was just like, something's wrong. I should go check it out. And so, it's a case that's always stuck with me, because more than anything, it told me about the power of flexing beyond your traditional thinking that care happens in a hospital, care happens in a clinic, and knowing that you have to meet patients where they're at, and you can just garner this wealth of information that's incredibly helpful if you go into a patient's home, right? So my view is, and what Livia was trying to solve for is, can we do this at scale for lots of patients who are complex, just like she was, right? And by the way, after we did this, we color coded her medications so she could see the big label, the colors and all of that. We explained it to her. We had her son more involved in her care. We figured out how to get a food pantry involved or a meal delivery service involved. And by the way, she never went to the hospital for the next 6 months. So you know what? It had nothing to do with her diabetes. None of that had anything to do with her diabetes. I mean, it did, like, the consequences of her medical condition resulted in that, but it wasn't really about the diabetes. So this lady who had been labeled as non-compliant, she doesn't listen. Well, I don't know why she doesn't get it. The issue was much deeper, right? And so how do we do this at scale? So Olivia is currently serving, almost 1,200, a little over 1,200 patients through our home-based palliative care and our wraparound model of care for complex patients. We currently serve patients in the metro area in Minnesota, as well as greater Minnesota as well, because we started in Minnesota. And our goal is to try to expand to take care of more of those patients initially in the state of Minnesota and potentially beyond as we prove out our model and get much better at extending beyond the urban environment and get better at taking care of patients who are in that outstate area where it's much, much more difficult to bring the right resources to bear for the care of these types of patients.
You know, you touch on something that's very poignant for a lot of clinicians, particularly those in a leadership role. And that's, when you're looking at a patient, there's a very strong tendency for clinicians to simply look at the guidelines, look at the recommendations, and assume that the solution is somewhere, in the midst of these, protocols. When in reality, a holistic approach is required, and by going into a patient's environment to see their actual access challenges or their hurdles, I think really helps see that and really allows for providers to leverage different resources to solve for the same problem. You're in in my opinion, of course, Sumer, you are in an unenviable position because you are looking to provide these solutions to people that are not necessarily indigent, but certainly handicapped. you know, whether they are living in an urban environment where, you know, we are talking like food deserts, we're talking about, you know, challenges that face a lot of particularly elderly, but now you're looking at expanding out into non-urban, suburban slash rural areas where access to care is much harder. You know, it's a big challenge. And, you know, I would love to understand a little bit about, as, and I've been watching, I know, the growth, and your, I've been reading your blog on Livio Health's website, just to see a lot of the insights that your company is sharing with anyone that's interested. You know, you've added on a pharmacist, you've, you know, brought in a brand new C-suite level leader that's talking about growth. You know, what are some of the challenges that you are working specifically to try and overcome in the next 12 months? I know that you're focused on right now a population predominantly in Minnesota, but I certainly know that that is not where the extent of your organization will be. Have you had challenges working with or trying to attract providers, attract new patients? Like, is it too fast, too slow? I'd love to hear your insights.
Yeah, I mean, depending on who you talk to, it's too fast or it's too slow, right? It's both at the same time. You know, the truth is that you want to have time to get the model right, right? And it's not like you flip a switch in the way you're caring for a patient or a specific change in your model, and then imagine that patients are immediately going to react to it, right? And so whatever change you make, small or large, in your model that you think will be beneficial to patients, it takes time to see if that bears fruit, right? And so from a clinical model development perspective, is you really want to get it right and spend the time necessary to do it. But there are, you know, challenges from a business perspective, that there's expectations that, hey, if you are in the business of taking care of these types of patients, that we need to see you touch as many of them as quickly as possible. So, you know, as and I consider ourselves to still be, you know, sort of like an, you know, in a startup phase, the challenges of growing fast and yet getting the model right, you know, there's some inherent tension there, right? And it's hard to strike the balance, but that's the challenge of leadership in these situations, is trying to figure out how to do it, right? And so, you know, I've been with the company for about a year now, and just in that time, we've almost doubled our size, right? And in the next year, the goal is to do that and more, right? And so I think that trying to figure out how to maintain your resilience for, in terms of the clinical team, scale your operations, and also make sure that you are not just making rash decisions because of the stresses of speed, right? It's an everyday battle, right? And all I can tell you is that you have to be as thoughtful as you can be in terms of helping or thinking about making the right decisions for your model and your team, while also in having enough flexibility to know that you can't, you have to just know that pivoting and making changes on the fly is part of the process, right? And I think in situations like this, sometimes trying to aim for perfection can be the enemy of good here, right? Whereas if you try to design for every possibility, you will fail because you don't even know what all the possibilities are yet, right? So when you think about expanding beyond the urban areas and getting into the rural side, that population needs help so badly, right? And when we make a referral to for a patient with lung disease to get physical therapy to improve their lung capacity, right? You suddenly realize that the closest facility is over 2 hours away. How are you going to get this patient with advanced lung disease to tolerate going somewhere 2 hours away, get maybe an hour of therapy if they're lucky, and then come back and then repeat that 3 times a week, right? Even simple things like, we need to have virtual connections with these patients quite frequently sometimes, and they don't have access to good broadband services. So yes, you can call them, but it's very hard to set up a video conference to see them because of broadband accesses, right? And so these types of challenges, you know, on the one hand, it's like, what has that got to do with healthcare? And the truth is everything, right? If you notice now some Medicare Advantage plans are thinking about covering broadband services for patients, And the whole reason is things like this, right? Broadband access gives you access to virtual care, which hopefully gives you access to care when you need it, because quite frankly, you live hours away from the closest place, right? So, you know, those are the types of things that make it difficult to realize this ideal state. Oh, we'll just get out there and start taking care of the rural population, and then realize, wow, there's all these things that come up that make it difficult. And again, the challenge is growing as fast as you can, and also making sure that things are actually getting nailed down as you go through that process.
It's difficult indeed. I mean, you know, it definitely requires a leader and an organization to be agile, but at the same time, you know, as you mentioned, like you're trying to balance efficiency and empathy, right? Like you have a team of people that are relying on you for guidance, for leadership, for vision, and they are also human beings that require an understanding or from a leadership level, like, hey, you're going through a tough time, let's hear about it. And at the same time, your patients are also in the same boat looking for that empathy. So it's this continuous cycle where one day or one moment, this is the priority, the next moment, that's the priority, and it's requiring a constant shift. So I can, like I said, you are in an unenviable position when I think about what you do, but it's a super important opportunity. And I'm glad that you're at the helm of this, because I think that somebody with your background, and we'll talk about that momentarily as well, I think that you can see a lot of the mistakes that other organizations may have made in the past, learn from that, and then are implying, you know, a lot of these lessons to be able to right size and move forward quickly. So Mary, you mentioned, you know, that a lot of organizations are seeing, you know, value in this space, you know, and are even taking bold leaps that are very non-traditional. You're talking about managed care groups that are looking to pay for broadband so that, you know, patients have access to this. How do you see like the business, or how would you say like home-based primary care as a business or as an industry, how do you see that changing over the next 5 years? Like, what will the world look like for patients and providers in 2027 when we think about providing these types of services at home?
Yeah, that's a really good question. I think it's going to see an immense amount of a combination, a lot of innovation, right? And there's, I think, going to be some disappointment as well, right? And I'll share what I mean by that in a second. So, you know, the first thing is just, what do we need to do to enable these models to be effective, right? And I kind of break it down into two major areas. But the first is the capabilities and the technology need to be effective, right? So when a clinician goes, or, you know, a social worker, an MA, anyone goes out to a patient's home, especially once you get to the edges of, you know, that urban environment, you don't have the resources of your entire clinic staff when things don't go as planned, right? And so you need to answer for that, but you're kind of by yourself with only a phone for support, right? So thinking about, well, what happens if you're with a complex patient and you need to answer some questions about their labs or get some information to help make the right diagnosis or decision, and your laptop doesn't work? Or like I said, that whole broadband issue actually affects you just as much as it affects that patient in that setting. So I think there needs to be a lot of work done to just enable people to care for patients well when they're out there in the community. And then the second piece of that is developing the workforce. Most of a clinical workforce doesn't work in these types of models of care. And I would venture to guess that very few, if any, training programs teach you about this as a career path, potentially. You're lucky, for example, if you work at a VA hospital and they have a home-based primary care program through a VA, which is one of the places where a lot of this stuff was pioneered, you may go on some rotations to do some home-based care, right? But most people aren't seeing that. So you don't have a lot of people who understand exactly what it is. And the other piece of it is, if you do know and you join, it's a very different type of existence. There's a sort of loneliness to doing this type of work. You don't have the camaraderie right there at your fingertips. And especially now that we provide so much virtual care, there may be many days before you even see a single team member of yours in person, right? And so how do you solve for the workforce challenges, just in terms of hiring and training them, but also in terms of maintaining resilience and allowing people to feel like they're part connected to something bigger when you're out there by yourself for days on end, where you might not have a lot of real, you know, open, like a face-to-face interaction with your own team members. So I think solving for that is something that's going to change over the next 5 years. I think another thing, we already talked about it, we need to have an answer for rural healthcare, right? It's very difficult to figure out a staffing model for how you go out hours beyond the largest city, right? So you need to think about, who do we partner with? Those rural community centers, right? Think about how can we plant certain resources in areas and then maybe create hubs within those areas that can then expand, right? So I think we have to answer the challenge for rural healthcare, and I think there'll be a lot of innovation there. And then the third thing I would say is, you know, there are so many companies. I mean, you almost read almost on a monthly basis, another couple have done their seed round and they're starting up. My worry is that there's so many, you know, players getting into this space, and each one of them have a little niche, that long term, there's going to be winners and losers in this process, and that there's going to be a wave of consolidation that's inevitably going to come in the next few years, just because there's resources being spread out amongst so many different organizations. And I don't know whether or not all these organizations can survive on their own, right? And then the last thing I would say is, there's so many different definitions of what home-based care means, right? There's home health, there's hospital at home, there's hospice programs, there's palliative care programs. There's, you know, independent primary care docs that still like to do that type, provide that type of care. And so, you know, I think that those folks that approach care from a comprehensive and holistic way are going to be the ultimate winners, right? You've got companies out there that are going out to do annual evaluations, right? Because Medicare requires them. There's companies going out that'll just do one or two visits to fill in some gaps in care, but then there's no longitudinal component to it, right? And so they're filling a need based on the incentives for care that exists today, but they're not, I don't think they're truly moving the needle on providing longitudinal relationships and care for these patients, right? And I think that those companies that are just going for little niches of the, like, you know, I'm just going to provide this service or that service, are not going to do as well as those that think more comprehensively about providing care in the home. And so I think there's going to be a shift in that direction as well. So those are somewhat changes, but they're all massive changes overall on what's going to happen in this home-based industry.
I think that's probably the most detailed answer I've ever received from a guest. And it's very accurate too, because you're describing all of the challenges that are kind of like converging, you know, in the very near future. And the fact is, there is a large amount of competition. I mean, just, you know, even if I switch industries and I think about streaming services, like, you know, at one point, all you had was Netflix, and everyone was like, oh, this is a fad, it's going to fade out. And then the next thing you know, you've got, of course, Disney Plus, Hulu, Vudu, I mean, a million of them, Paramount Plus. And now the conversation is shifting towards exactly this, is that there's too much competition. And, you know, compounded in this particular case is the lack of accurate and longitudinal care that's being provided. So, you know, it'll be interesting to see how quickly, and I don't mean this in any, in a way of disrespect, but these are predictions, and I believe that these predictions are super accurate. So I think it's really just a matter of seeing how quickly these predictions will come to pass. I don't know necessarily if it will be 5 years, but I certainly see a lot of this is like, you know, all these, you know, companies that have, you know, seed money or, you know, unicorn status, they're growing very quickly, and they're certainly gaining venture capitalist investment. But, you know, is it sustainable? And I think that that's really, really a good call out. Sumer, you know, one of the things that I really pride myself about starting this podcast is because, you know, when I was younger, you know, you didn't really have a lot of non-traditional role models. You sort of had this idea that, hey, you know, I'm going to pursue this healthcare discipline. I'm going to be the best in my trade. I'm going to stay in this space. I'm going to learn everything I can. And as, you know, as the protocols change, I'll become a subject matter expert in cardiology, you know, pharmacology, oncology, whatever the story is. But, you know, there's been a shift over the last couple of years, but it's, in my opinion, it's not as quick as I would like, because I see many healthcare professionals not venturing out and above into leadership roles. And I'm not sure if you are seeing this or if you've had the same experience or not, but, you know, where do you see you know, physicians, particularly physicians, like how do you see them, you know, embracing or avoiding leadership roles in the near future? Is that something that's even on their radar per se?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So I would say that we sorely need more physician, and I don't just mean physician, I'm talking about clinician leadership, right? I think our nurse practitioner partners or PAs or others, nurses are very, very capable leaders. And some of the best that I've seen are non-physicians. But yeah, if you think about clinical leadership, it is so sorely needed because what is our job? Our job is to figure out how to take care of patients, right? And so if you don't have a very robust clinical perspective in the decisions that are being made about how these models are being developed and how these incentives are being created, then you can kind of guess what you're going to end up with. You're going to end up with something that doesn't meet needs of the needs of the people who are responsible for being at that bedside, right? And it's going to be difficult to get that patient perspective too, right? And so I think we need it. We need to nurture it, right? And that it starts all the way back when you were training, giving people those opportunities, right? Having the opportunity for places like Libio and others to allow people to come and see what it's like a day in the life of an individual like that. It's our job, my job, the job of all the other clinical leaders out there to be willing to open themselves up to mentorship and, you know, talking through it, right? So I feel like I went through this process not because I had a clear path to getting there. I mean, there was certainly a lot of, it just, I happened to know somebody, right? Or I just happened to read something. But I think that if people knew what's out there and they knew the opportunities that exist, and there's just so much variety of leadership roles that can be played by clinicians of all types, then I think there would be more interest overall, right? So, you know, for me, I just had friends in the right places who suggested that I reach out, you know. But I think this is one thing I would tell folks, right? A lot of us go through our day as clinicians griping or being upset about this doesn't work and it never works, or that doesn't work and it never works, right? And I think your ability to have influence there, all right, it starts right there. Like, don't keep asking the question and then not taking the time to try and answer it. And when you say, hey, let me figure out how to answer it, you start searching, and often it'll open up a whole window of opportunities because it's like, wow, nobody knows the answer to this question. Or these are some really intelligent people that have tried to answer it. I have some thoughts. Why can't I be involved in the conversation? And little things like that can then lead to those different doors opening up, right? For me, it was, I loved acute medicine. I loved working in the hospital, but I couldn't get over the fact that too many of my patients kept coming back after I sent them home 2 weeks later, 3 weeks later, 4 weeks later. And I kept asking myself that question until that day came when I was like, who is trying to solve this problem? And then I realized, wow, there's so much stuff I don't know, that I ended up connecting to certain folks. And then we got to a point where, I ended up going down this career trajectory that I've had.
I think that's really good call out. So what I'm hearing in this, Sumer, is those in leadership need to make themselves more available for people, just even from in terms of exposure, let alone mentorship. Now, because mentorship is a two-way street. Not only does the mentor have to offer himself or herself, but the mentee also has to reach out and either ask or grab. And sometimes it's the mentee that chooses, you know, to dwell in their lack of confidence, because I've had a lot of clients where they are sort of like, I really need a mentor. Well, have you identified one? Yeah, but you know, I just don't know if they're available, and I don't know if I should reach out to them. Like, yes, you should always. It's a two-way street, but leadership should be a requirement. Like, you should go and make yourself available and visible and give yourself exposure to people that you've not met before, so that they have an understanding of, hey, here's an avenue of consideration. Here's something that can be an opportunity for me, and then to pursue that as well. I kind of want to go one step deeper into this, right? Because we've talked about clinicians moving into leadership roles, and I would agree, you know, there are as many There are many healthcare executives who do not have a healthcare background that do well in their roles and do provide positive impact, but there is just something extra from a clinical provider where they're able to combine their knowledge, skills, and abilities and experiences and marry it into a more meaningful process. The challenge, however, now is that not just taking that umbrella of people or that class of individuals that we've just talked about, but going deeper to recognize that, you know, we are living in a very diverse population where we have, you know, 33% of our country is African-American or more, 25% are Latino, but the representation at both patient-facing provider level and leadership level is sorely, sorely, almost inverse. I mean, it's really remarkable. And, you know, I'll just say it, like, you know, we're both from an Indian Pakistani background. We both are Muslim. You know, I don't remember seeing a lot of Indian Pakistani Muslim leaders when I was going up and through my professional journey. And I don't know if you felt that, but I can imagine as another, you know, person of color, whatever, you know, whichever race they may be, like, they're looking for that kind of representation and it's not there. And I just kind of like to hear your insights in terms of how, you know, you're helping to change that within Livio Health or within the industry, or what suggestions do you have to kind of counteract this current, you know, this current situation that we find ourselves in?
Yeah. You know, this question is certainly in vogue these days, right? A lot of healthcare organizations are hiring leaders in DEI, right? Chief diversity officers, et cetera. And, you know, a question I always ask myself is how much of this is a response to feeling like you need to do something so that you can show that you did something versus actually laying out a real longitudinal program for how your organization is going to tackle this problem, right? And the clinical leaders certainly need to step up. We've got a major issue, right? So one of my proudest moments in my career has been, you know, I was the clinical leader for a team that was caring for, you know, several thousand fully at risk and overall relatively sick population of Medicare patients, right? And it was, we were not really doing all that well from either a clinical outcomes perspective or a financial perspective, right? It was a problem that was deep, and but something we had to answer for because thousands of patients were relying on us, right? And was being cared for by a team of almost 180 or so people. Like, there were a lot of people, there was a lot at stake, right? And so I got together with the other clinical leaders and my, you know, business and operations partners were all new in our roles at the time. And, you know, we set in motion a program to try to turn things around. And I think we focused on the right KPIs and made sure we thought about culture and sort of had a systematic approach. And, you know, we were able to really actually turned the market around, right? And we're really looked back and said, wow, we actually did something, right? Because we were able to meet all of our clinical outcomes and our financial outcomes moving forward, and not just for a week or a month, but quarter after quarter after quarter. And so I think back, like, why were we successful? I don't consider myself to be the most intelligent person, nor do I think that any one individual is ultimately responsible for this type of success. And when I think back, I am very convinced that a big reason for success was because our team was so diverse, right? From a gender perspective, from an experience perspective, from a race perspective. And the truth is, we weren't trying to do that. We were just looking for people who we thought would be good in those leadership roles and put them there, right? And so I keep asking myself, if we can do it that way, you know, why can't that just be replicated across the industry? Because we weren't even trying back then. Diversity, inclusion, it wasn't even like, it wasn't a thing that was shared in healthcare all the time. We all knew that we had to do it, but there were no chief diversity officers. None of that stuff was happening at the time we did this. And yet we were able to get it done, right? So I've seen firsthand the value that diversity brings, right? And so I just have to realize that it is part of my job to bring in talent and to that is diverse. And it's actually not that hard once you just commit to it. Like, it's just maybe a little bit difficult to get over the inertia of just starting, right? But having certain things where, you know, in order to hire a certain position, you need to have interviewed a couple of diverse candidates, that you need to go to schools where you have diverse populations going there and like seek out the talent there, right? That you need to have community partnerships to help, like we talked about, mentor and share like the possibilities for people getting into healthcare that, you know, they can too be leaders, right? You have to think about how you fit, your organization fits into the community, fits into the right schools, fits into the right training programs. And then the last thing I would say is you have to look at your own conscious and unconscious biases and call them out and say that they exist, and then put your foot down and say that we have to change this. Otherwise, we are not doing our jobs, right? So why isn't a racial and health equity KPI part of your organizational goals? And if you don't hit them, you have missed on one of your KPIs, right? Why aren't you going out there and forming those real connections with those training programs and finding those people and bringing them in, right? I promise you, they're just as intelligent people there and they will help you succeed. But I think those people, because they haven't been approached in a way that, you know, the more traditional folks have been approached, there's a sense of, I don't know if I belong. I don't know if they want me. I don't even know what's out there because no one comes to talk to me about this. So I think if you put in that program in place, and it'll vary a little bit based on the specific community you're talking about, but if you like go beyond just, hey, let's get like this chief diversity officer hired and checkbox, and that's your approach, you won't make any changes. But if it goes beyond just a checkbox activity, I think you can do an incredible amount to get buy-in that this is the right thing to do.
I love the accountability factor that you've inserted into this conversation, because this is something that, you know, working in talent acquisition for 15 years and continuing to see how organizations are still struggling with this, because it's very reactive. Some organizations, I will admit that they have actually had this as part of their, vision and mission for some time, but that's how they were sort of like created. The traditional standard organization, the one that's been around, like they don't have that as a metric where people and especially leaders can be held accountable. And I love the fact that, you know, you're bringing this to the forefront as a leader to say, you know, this is part and parcel of what makes Levio different. And, you know, that's the only way that we know it's effective, because if we just say it, then we just said it. That's it. That's all there is to it. There's no meat behind the saying. And I'm really, really glad that you shared that.
Iqbal, I'll tell you that, I'll just quickly say that even I have felt this, right? So once I joined Levio and I went to our office for the first time and I saw a prayer room in the office, like right there. Because, you know, we pray a couple of times a day during the day and it happens at work. And I'm used to praying in closets or in closing doors and finding rooms that are unoccupied and trying to pray really quickly. I kept like that day. The only thing I could think about was like, wow, someone thought to have a prayer room in this office. And it makes me feel so special I was like, wow, what if you could do little things like that? And it's just part of your DNA. Right. You just think about it and it gets done. How many more people would be likely to stick around from diverse backgrounds because they feel like, wow, someone thought about my unique need here and did this little thing for me. And it's things like that, that, you know, it's not that hard to do. Right. And yet, if you don't think about it, you don't do it. So I myself have felt, seen the benefit of doing it that way. And I hope that other organizations sort of catch on.
You know, and that's a super, super critical call out, especially in the phase of the great resignation and the great reshuffle that we're seeing. I mean, this episode will probably air in a couple of weeks since we've recorded this, right? But I don't really see that the job market is going to change that dramatically in three weeks. You know, the fact of the matter is that healthcare professionals are leaving the profession. They're not just taking a backseat and like, oh, I'm just going to think about this and just go, you know, vacation for a while. They have decided that, hey, It's retirement is long overdue. I'm taking, this opportunity now to leave, and the backfill is not there. And then you also have those people that, while they may be in their primes, are very disenchanted. But, you know, as you call out, like, if you as an organization can recognize what employees value, and as you pointed out, like the DNA that makes up your employee, and add to that, like, a lot of this is based on trust and communication. Right. Like, if you don't know, ask somebody that you trust. Like, hey, I'm just asking because I'm curious. Would this be appropriate if we offered this to this new individual that's joining our team? Would it fit with their culture? And get some feedback from that. And I think that's where most people do miss the mark. So to recognize that, hey, from a retention perspective, from a talent attraction perspective, and just from, employee engagement, like, these are simple little lifts that organizations can do to really ensure longevity with their staff and more meaningful work for across the board. I know. So, Sumer, I want to step away from the professional side. We spent quite a bit of time in that. I want to talk more about you. Like, you are a very interesting individual with a broad range of experiences. I know that currently you are the Chief Clinical Officer of Levio Health. Prior to this, you served as the Vice President of Stella Health, which I believe is the parent company of Blue Cross Blue Shield of Minnesota.
I actually serve in both capacities because Stella Health is the parent organization. So I'm a vice president there, but as the vice president, my main function is to be the clinical leader for Levio Health.
Excellent. Thank you for that clarification. So in addition to that, you were also served previously as the chief medical officer at CareMore Health, I believe on the east side, east region, correct? And then even before that, you served as a staff vice president at Anthem and then an associate doctor at Iora Health. So you've had an opportunity to not only interact with a variety of patients across the country and see how different systems and processes are put into play and then, do continuous improvement to help elevate the way that care is delivered. When this opportunity presented itself, like, what were some of the parameters or factors that you looked into to decide if this aligned with your priorities? What were some of the things that stuck out to you when you were first approached about this opportunity to think, this would be a good step and here's why?
That's a good question. So, after deciding that I wanted to focus my career on caring for and developing care models for chronically ill patients, I've had a lot of just wonderful mentors and people that have ultimately vouched for me and given me the opportunity to take on larger roles over time where, I started off as a PCP with my own panel of patients, and then I got to be the medical director of my clinic, and then I got to be the leader of a market, and then I got to be a leader of a region. And in each step, you feel like there's so much learning, right? But one of the things that I was yearning for and something that got me really excited was going to something that was earlier stage in its evolution, right? And trying to figure out exactly what that care model was going to be that was going to deliver these incredible, clinical outcomes for patients and a sustainable business model into the future. And, the folks that I met at Levio and at Stella ultimately were just really committed and positive and upbeat that you could really achieve this aim of better care, better team satisfaction, and reduce total cost of care all at the same time. Sort of that triple aim, quadruple aim that we talk about. And sort of like the passion, the institutional backing, right? And the runway that you needed to feel like, hey, I can have some time to get this right and figure this out, was really exciting for me. And to be able to do that with, your sort of care delivery organization in very close concert with a strongly aligned payer partner, right, is not something that you always find in healthcare, right? So I feel like from that regional level, now, I'm back to sort of working with this smaller team and a smaller number of patients. But I think you see the drive and the passion of the people and what they're trying to accomplish and feel like, wow, I can really have an impact working with them to develop a model of care based on everything that I've learned and then everything that all these folks are bringing to the table too, to help set us well for where home-based healthcare is going in the future. And for me, this opportunity was the right one, and that's how I ended up here. You know, but one thing I would share, if I can give advice to people, is that I hear from people all the time, Sumer, I really like this job, but I just don't know if I'm ready to take that step. And to which I respond, well, I guess what? There's other people that apparently think you're ready, and that's why you're getting this opportunity. I can promise you that you will never feel 100% ready to take that next step. But the truth is, as long as you feel like you can be confident that the skills that you've already developed will help you, and that you have a willingness to learn what you don't know in a way that's humble, I will always tell you to go for that next thing if you want it, right? Because if you doubt yourself because you feel like, oh, I still have so much more to learn, it was just like, well, you're a clinician. Do you know everything about healthcare? Do you know everything about every disease? No, you've already committed to a career that's devoted to lifelong learning, and clinical leadership can be like that too. So take what you know, apply it, figure out what you don't know, learn it. And that is how you keep sort of moving along that sort of leadership journey. So anyone who's listening to this, if I can tell you one thing, like if someone's giving you a shot, like don't doubt yourself. They're giving you a shot because they already see something in you that you will help you get to the next level, and that there's plenty of people out there to help you fill in the rest of the gaps in your knowledge to get you to where you need to be.
I'm so glad you've said that. You know, there is a oversupply of knowledge and education, and in a lack of confidence in that education and experience. At least this is what I see. Like whenever I work with my clients who are also healthcare professionals and executives, like they come to a point in their career where they're dissatisfied where they're at, but they're not confident enough to take the leap based on what they've already done, because they feel that there's still more steps that they need to add to this bridge before they cross the bridge. And you're right. Like when there's somebody that has called you out and that says, you know, Iqbal, there's something here that I think that you would be a great fit for. We believe, you know, we've seen you do this, you should do it. And you're second guessing yourself in that conversation. What you're also doing is second guessing their judgment. So your sponsor, the person that's, you know, said, hey, I want you to do this, and you are unsure, you're also second guessing them. And that's kind of dangerous. So I always tell my, you know, people, like, take this as a huge compliment. Use this as an opportunity to bolster your own confidence that you, somebody else sees something in you that you don't, and trust them. Trust them, because if they've identified whatever qualities or skills or abilities through physical or observation, you know, that's a huge win. Sumer, you know, one of the things that, you know, you mentioned just a few moments ago is about being humble. You know, to be able to be confident in your skills, but at the same time, humble. And I think that you'll agree that, you know, while we have been very fortunate to have experienced a lot of new challenges and new opportunities, you know, many of those successes that we have today under our belt really are not a result of our own effort or our own individual endeavors. It's because somebody was there to, you know, guide us, push us, or even speak on our behalf. Is there a particular individual that when you think about your career that you really would like to thank using this show as that platform to just, you know, acknowledge their contributions towards your success?
Yeah, honestly, the number of people that I need to thank are just too numerous, and I feel bad leaving anybody out. But I hope this doesn't sound perhaps cliche, but at the end of the day, if I have to thank anyone for the career path that I've taken, it's, you know, yeah, I just have to thank my parents, right? You know, my parents are immigrants. Their lives were very, very tough growing up. You know, they've been through things that, you know, when you hear about, it's like, wow, this is the kind of stuff I saw about hardships people face in movies. Like, it's not real to you because it's just, you don't want to see it. Like, you can want to imagine that your parents went through the things that they went through, but they did. And yet they had the courage to, you know, move to a different country, give us a different life, you know, allow us to get educated And that's the reason I can do anything that I can do, right? Because they created those opportunities for me. So from my mom's perspective, you know, she sacrificed all of her own fun, all of her own pleasure to raise five kids. I, you know, I'm the oldest of that group, but she was there with us every step of the way, right? She taught me that it just is not about you. It's about the people that you serve. It's about your family that you serve. It's about your patients that you serve. And that you just have to be okay that if you want to make an impact, you have to give up some of what you care about most so that other people can benefit from your efforts. So, you know, that's what I learned from her and from my dad. You know, he was a no excuses kind of guy. He's like, guess, and you hear this all the time, but it's like, your life is not as hard as mine was. It just isn't. You have challenges too, but they're different. And that, you know, you take your lumps, you move on, you ignore the haters, and you get done what you've been asked to do, period. And nothing else, you know, nothing else is acceptable. And so, you know, knowing that he came here and, you know, not that he was overall, you know, from a, he had spent enough time in, you know, Western countries to learn the language and know some of how people acted and thought. But at the end of the day, he moved out here, gave up a decent career that he had built up for himself, right? Didn't know how to navigate, somehow still managed to deliver pizza for Domino's, right, when he got here. I don't even know how he did that without GPS, to be completely honest. You know, and then he built himself back up again and got him to a place where the family could, all of us could go to good schools and learn and study and build ourselves up. So, I have a lot of professional mentors that I could thank, but at the end of the day, I wouldn't even be in this profession or do any of these things if it wasn't for the efforts that they put in. So they get first dibs on the appreciation, I think.
So I'm glad that you called them out. I'm the caregiver of three 80-year-olds. My dad, who's 85, mom 82, and mother-in-law 81. And you know, there's even at the age of 50, you know, I still feel like there is so I want as much time as I can with them to repay them for what they invested in me. And there's no, I think that you'll agree, like there's no way that you'll ever even get close to 50% of a repayment. But, you know, they set such a high bar for their children, your parents for you, my parents for me. And it's because of that foundation that they lay for us that really just kind of defines how we approach problems, how we approach, you know, what our attitude is. And that really is where the credit goes. So thank you for sharing that. And what are their names, by the way?
Aziz and Shada.
Aziz and Shada. Very cool. You know, you mentioned already, you know, we talked a little bit about, you know, a professional achievement that you were very proud of. You know, is there something early that happened to you perhaps in your professional career that kind of changed the way that you were progressing or viewing your career? Because I know a lot of times, like, you know, there's an idea that you create in your mind, like, oh, I'm going to do this. And then obviously the next step is that. And if I do this, then the next step is that. We have this linear, you know, ideology of if we just do this, then the next step comes. But in reality, life is very, very, very interconnected and definitely all over the place. And I'd really be curious, like, was there a moment in time that challenged your paradigm and then redefined the way that you see professional endeavors for yourself?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think if I were to think back during my medical school training or my residency, I would never, ever in a million years have thought that this is what I would be doing from a career perspective. I mean, it wouldn't even be like, it's so foreign as I think back to my younger self. So, you know, I was sure that I was going to be an interventional cardiologist. And then the first big change from that was I decided to do general medicine, right? Because I love taking care of any patient that came through, right? I just like that, the general approach. And then you know, as I was a hospitalist, I realized that I kept asking these burning questions, as I mentioned before, about why these patients don't get better long-term. Why are they spending more time with me than they are at home? And, you know, those burning questions led me to start thinking about, well, how am I going to answer this, these questions? And thankfully, I got connected to people in the field who were bold enough and just frankly, just brave enough to say, I'm going to try to fix this, right? And to me, that was like something that challenged me, where I was very used to this sort of you do your med school, then you do your residency, then you do your fellowship, then you find a job, then you build up your panel of patients, and then you just take care of them, right? It's like very cookie cutter and set up for you. But these were folks who had gone out and said, I'm going to just change the system. I'm done talking about it. I'm done being frustrated. I don't like the fact that the system is not supporting what I think is best for the way these patients should be cared for. So I'm going to, you know, find someone to give me some money, take a little chance on me, and then invest my own if I need to, and just go out and do it. And, you know, clinicians are not, they are risk averse people, right? We are meant to avoid putting patients at risk, and therefore it pervades like our thought process. And so for someone, a clinician who is willing to say, I'm just going to take this chance and try to build something, is not something that you see very commonly, right? And so as I met more people like that, like Rashika, who was the, you know, founder and CEO of Iora, you know, people like Sachin Jain, who's just incredible work around, you know, thinking about how to provide better care to a homeless population, and right, to think about how we tackle things like loneliness. The more I spend time with people like that, right, the more you realize that you can ask questions and choose to answer them yourself also, and then connect with other people that are thinking the same way, right? And it's been a process for me learning how to do that, you know, and had I not had certain opportunities, I just would not have probably gone down this path at all. So I feel like everything I knew about healthcare has been like severely challenged. But for me, it's turned out to be the reason I love my job and think I do like the best thing I could possibly be doing for a career. And, you know, so and I think, so, you know, if I were to tell people, you know, I would say find people that are smarter than you and stay connected to them. And find people who think differently than you, because we all have a tendency to find people we like because they think like us, and we have the same worldview and the same thing that should happen in healthcare, and that's great. But I think if you challenge yourself to connect with people who, why, and ask yourself, why does this person think differently than me, right? If it can often lead to you starting to challenge some of your own assumptions about what should and shouldn't be in healthcare, and then that can lead to some surprising findings about yourself, and put you in a position to, you know, uncover certain opportunities that you otherwise wouldn't have thought about.
I think that's amazing. Thank you, Sumer, for that. And you are right. Like, groupthink is a very scary, very, very detrimental, self-inflicted wound, I would say. You know, a lot of times people do find themselves just attracting like-minded individuals. There's no different perspective, no growth. And you end up isolating yourself in this process, both professionally and personally in this space. So you're right. Go where the waters are blue and find new people with new ideas. Because if you don't have somebody that's challenging you and looking at the same thing in a different way, you're going to get a faulty product or a service or a delivery that is not going to be as beneficial as you think it is. Sumer, let's turn to you about as a person, right? Like, you know, we've talked a lot about the clinical side. We've talked about leadership. We've talked about professionalism. But just like myself and everyone else on this planet, you're a human being. And we are all looking to try to be better, both, you know, from a personal perspective. Is there like a speaker, an author, somebody that you usually turn to for guidance or just inspiration? Because, you know, you're on a podcast today. Hopefully there are people that are listening today that will be inspired by you and maybe will follow you. But how about you? Like, who do you recommend to others to listen to as a way of growing as a human being?
Wow, that's a hard question. You know, I think it ultimately it's a conglomeration of a few different folks and a few different resources that I utilize to keep myself grounded and thinking about the right things. But I will say that, you know, when I was back at Iora, we had a lot of our leaders read, you know, a book called, or a system or book called Tribal Leadership, right? And it sort of helps you think about leading through change and how teams progress through change and describes them as tribes, right? And ascribe certain characteristics to tribes based on where they are in the process of change, right? And actually, if you read it, the concept is applicable to a lot of change management approaches when you're thinking about teams. And, you know, people have often grown up with the norming, storming, performing type of thing. There's tribal leadership, there's others. But it has really helped me think through what I have seen over and over and over again, leading a few different organizations as to how a team starts off, how it progresses as you start introducing change, and how everything sort of feels like it's falling apart when you're going through that process, and how as you come around to the other side of the equation, if you stay faithful to the process of changing and stay on the right track, that you can get to this stage where like everyone is doing the job that you had always dreamed of, right? And your team is really doing well. And I think it's really important that if you're going to be a change agent in healthcare, that you internalize and accept that there is a process that you have to go through, and it seems chaotic, but it follows a very similar pattern every single time in terms of what you and your team have to go through to go from a stage where you're trying to figure it out to a stage where a lot of, you know, it seems like things are just not going that well, to a stage where people start to see the light at the end of the tunnel, and then finally get to a place where they need to be. And if you don't learn that that process is going to play itself out, you can misinterpret where you are in that process and therefore sometimes be demoralized to the point where you don't want to keep going. And that's the absolute wrong thing to do when you're trying to change something, right? And so, you know, I think that the concepts around managing change are things that I read a lot about, and tribal leadership just happens to be one that I have that stuck with me over the years. But I will also tell people that this idea that you can read your way through success as a leader, right, is it's like parenting. You can read all the parenting books in the world, and then your children come, and then you just have to figure it out, right? You know, people always ask me and my wife, right, like, how did you guys raise four kids? You know, you're working a lot. How did you raise four kids? I was like, I didn't have a choice. Like, what am I not going to raise them, right? So you have to do it, and you learn by doing, right? So all the parenting and self-help books and all of that, they do give you guidance and they help you think differently. But at the end of the day, people have to realize that you just have to get out there and do it. You know, put your neck on the line sometimes and just try things as a leader. Be willing to make mistakes, knowing that if you haven't made any mistakes, you're just not doing the job right, in my opinion. And just keep pushing. And you will eventually get to the other side if you stay faithful to what you committed to do from the very beginning, right? So that grounds me. And when I have tough days or I feel like things aren't going well, I remember, you know, but what am I trying to accomplish? What am I doing here? Why did I set out to do this? And it always reminds me, like, you know what? It's still the right thing to do, so I should keep pushing.
So, man, that's so... It's deep, man, it's deep, but it's very accurate too. And I think that there's a small population probably out there that understands. Sometimes you find yourself in a situation, well, what was I supposed to do? Like, I didn't have a choice. I had to do it. And I think that that's where most people find their breakthrough, is that when they do push themselves past that point of despair, past that point of impossibility, they realize they actually have it within them to do it. Thanks for sharing these two sources and kind of walking through this. So, man, this has been an outstanding conversation, very insightful, very deep. We went in a lot of crooks and a lot of, you know, nooks and crannies, and I thought that was great. You know, if there's one final piece of advice that you would share to the listening audience, maybe even if you think about it, like if you could go back in time and talk to your younger self for a young, hungry clinician looking to move up or looking to try new things, like what would you tell that person as a piece of advice to say, hey, you know, at the end of the day, either try this or know this? What would that one thing that we haven't talked about yet is something that you would share to the audience right now?
Yeah, I think perhaps two things, right? The first thing I would share is I wish I had been told earlier on and had been taught that the concept of taking risk can be a really good thing, right? Because I think nothing great in healthcare was ever accomplished by just following the usual course and not taking risks, right? Every major innovation that we've had, right? Whether it's a scientific innovation or it's a change in the way we take care of patients, right? Has been about people willing to take some serious risks and often being ostracized by the rest of the clinical community that because it is risk averse, will often shut down new ideas, right? I hope that's starting to change, but I think it still exists to a large degree, particularly in some of our more traditional academic centers that have always kind of had a certain worldview of how healthcare should be delivered. So I would, you know, tell people like, ask yourself what you care about most and, you know, just be willing to take a risk in trying to answer it. And if you look deep enough, you'll find somebody else who is asking the same question. And then that turns into two people and then three people and four people. And now all of a sudden you have a little community of people trying to answer the same question and something awesome can come out of that, right? So I think that's the first thing. And then the other thing I would say is for people who have had a little more experience and more time, we talked about this a little bit when we were talking about things like, you know, mentorship, but share a piece of yourself back to the larger healthcare community. Don't assume that there's lots of people out there sharing what you have learned, right? And that therefore everyone's fine. The truth is you probably are going to be in the minority if you do choose to share, right? And the knowledge that you can impart to a new generation of clinicians that are coming up can be the reason that they're inspired enough to choose to work a little bit differently than the traditional way that they've been taught to in healthcare. And I think, I think it's more of a duty for all of us to do that, but I know that not everyone would necessarily agree. But I think for those of us who can share even a little bit, go talk to residents, go talk to medical students, let someone come and shadow you in your clinic, right? Just give them the opportunities, particularly those who have generally been part of marginalized groups. And I think if all of us invested a little bit of time, I'm just trying to think of what it would do for the healthcare workforce overall. So I hope people can take that and think about ways that they can give back.
I'm confident people will take that under advisement, but I'm even more bullish on the fact that people will start to apply that. So Mary, you've been an outstanding guest. Thank you so much for being on the Healthcare and Hire podcast this evening. I mean, it's been remarkable. And you know, as I look forward to seeing how you succeed the rest of this year, I'm looking forward to seeing how you and Levio Health continue to take healthcare to a higher level.
Thank you, Iqbal. It was a lot of fun.
Thanks for joining me on this episode of the Healthcare and Hire podcast. If you liked what you heard, be sure to follow and subscribe for more. I'm your host, Iqbal Acha, and I invite you to connect with me on LinkedIn, Instagram, and Twitter. Let me know what you thought about this episode or my show in general. Also, visit me at www.achainternational.com to learn more about how I help healthcare professionals and healthcare leaders advance their career, build a better brand, and create a leadership legacy. I'll be back next week with another episode. But until then, let's keep working to take healthcare to a higher level.